part of the reason why Vibes language grew popular on the internet in the early 2020s is because it's a vernacularization of the practices of perception that the algorithms in the black boxes use to perceive us.
I've come to realize, as you'll hear me admit in the opening of this interview, that I'm not much of a philosophical person. The more I understand what I like to do as a musicologist and what I do well as a musicologist, and it's taken me a while to figure this out, the more I understand that I'm at my best as a thinker when I'm super grounded in historical detail, writing about the specificity of people's lives and music making. It would be easy then for me to dismiss very theoretical or philosophical scholarship about music as overly jargony or removed in some way from historical reality. But I'm not going to do that because even though it's not how I personally like to do music scholarship, it is hugely important and often revelatory. And that's definitely the case for the work of our guest today, Robin James, who is editor for philosophy and media studies at the publisher Palgrave Macmillan. Many, many of the ideas that Dr. James has developed in her work have become totally lodged in my brain, and I end up thinking about them anytime I hear Taylor Swift or Beyoncé or Adele. I wanted to dig into what led Dr. James to develop a philosophical approach towards understanding pop music and culture, and how that's different from so much philosophical work done on music, and how it's driven her current, ongoing project, focused on understanding the ideology of vibes today. This is a heady conversation, but also a very grounded one, and I think you'll enjoy it. So I've been thinking a little bit about kind of like how to start this conversation, and this might be a kind of long-winded question, but like, you know, I would not consider myself to be like a philosophy person. Like, I don't like thinking very metaphysically or abstractly, even though I kind of briefly considered philosophy in college. And I also, you know, occasionally check in on the world of music and philosophy as a subfield. And I'm often a little turned off by it because it seems like a narrow conception of what music can be and sometimes a narrow conception of what philosophy can be. And I don't think that's the case for your work. It seems like your work is, I think it's fair to say, not that at all. And I'm wondering if you can maybe try to talk a little bit about, like, do you see yourself as a music philosophy scholar in a different way than all the other kind of music and philosophy scholars, and what you see that meaning, if that makes sense?
Yeah. And this is kind of always, I mean, going back to graduate school, primarily we've been the question of, like, what am I even doing? Right? And who is my audience and who are my interlocutors? Because I came up, I mean, maybe, I'll ask the question, do I see myself? I think I'm definitely a sound studies scholar.
Okay.
I think that's pretty clear, right? And I think that's the case because sound studies is so inherently interdisciplinary that you don't have to be a thing, right? You just do sound and everybody's coming from different perspectives, and that's fine. So it's okay to have fuzzier boundaries, I think, in sound studies, if that makes sense.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. But am I a philosopher? Well, not in only a very bad one if you're sort of taking mainstream academic philosophy as like your your gauge, right? Because I came up in philosophy through the continental feminist philosophy, right? So I always kind of felt on the margins of the philosophy world because that's where I was, right? You know, I knew that like what I was doing was definitely not mainstream. And I approach music as someone working from that perspective. So like I never engage philosophy of music, right? Like that's the only thing I've ever published in the Aesthetics Journal is a book review.
Okay.
Right? Like, that's just not my world. Those aren't my questions, right? Because, you know, mainstream Anglophone philosophy of music is interested primarily in ontology and emotions.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And those are not the kinds of questions I'm interested in asking, right? Like, I'm interested in the political questions and the social questions that,
right.
You know, it might be very unsurprising for a feminist philosopher to ask.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, yeah. Like, I think when I think of like music and philosophy, I think of like Nietzsche and Wagner or just like,
yeah.
or this, you know, kind of like, let's take a philosopher and understand how to apply their approach to a 19th century symphony's musical tones or something like that.
Yeah.
Which is not what you do.
No, I would, because I think what I do is I use music as a, I don't, maybe as a text to kind of like, here's a concrete, or one way I put it often is I'm interested in society, and society is big and complicated. Pop songs are 3 minutes long. And if you take pop song, if you understand pop songs as like a product of society and reflecting some of the structures, that, you know, sort of the macro structures like gender or race or political structures, if those are reflected in pop songs, then pop songs are a very digestible, understandable thing to analyze,
right,
to help get at these much more abstract, higher level political structures or social structures, right? So it's really, I'm sort of theorizing bottom up from what's going on in music as a way to sort of do philosophy rather than saying like, here's a canonical philosopher and let's apply this top down and just sort of see what, you know, I don't know, philosopher X can tell us about, I don't know, romanticism or
sure.
You know, like that's right. Cause I'm really interested in, like I said, that sort of bottom up work. You know, music reflects how people understand them and how they think the world works. And if we're interested in trying to unpack that philosophically, that's a helpful place to start.
Right. And I mean, I think traditionally the 3 minute pop song wouldn't be the purview of a philosopher because they wouldn't see it as quote unquote philosophical in some way. Right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think too, like this is, so I think the two important texts I read as a philosopher early on was Norma Coates's article, early article sort of on teeny boppers and, you know, sort of feminist popular music studies, right? I'm like, oh, okay, this is the kind of scholarship that can be done about popular music. But then also my undergrad music theory professor made me read Feminine Endings. She's like, you should read this. So this is like 1997, I want to say, 7, 8, right? So that book was still relatively new back then. And I was like, oh, and this is the kind of work that can be done, you know, with music, right? So, and I think too, because I was already on the margins of philosophy anyway, as a feminist continental philosopher, I was like, I don't care if you don't take this seriously, like pop song seriously, you don't take feminist philosophy seriously. So why should I bother getting trying to be taken seriously? I'll just do my own thing because I think it's worth doing.
Yeah. So like what is your trajectory to that in terms of you have a music background and a philosophy background? Like, was it like I liked classical music and Plato and then I veered off in this other direction, or like how, what's the kind of trajectory?
Sure.
To?
Yeah, I guess. So I started off college as an oboe major and I thought I wanted to be a conductor. And then, I mean, it was a mix of things. I discovered music theory and I was like, oh, this is way more interesting. Right? Like, this is how I want to engage music. I know maybe that makes me weird, but I'm also a philosopher. So it's
I was going to say there are other reasons that you might be weird, but I think anyone I talk to on this podcast can characterize themselves as weird.
Yeah. So I started college as an oboe major and I took a philosophy class also my first semester just to fulfill requirements. And, you know, for a mix of reasons that included things like me realizing that what interested me about music was more the sort of theoretical, philosophical, scholarly questions about it and less sort of performance. And oddly enough, me experiencing less misogyny in a philosophy department than a music department led me to sort of be doing kind of work that was at the intersection of philosophy and music. But then when it was time to apply to grad schools, I was like, you know, where do I, you know, do I apply to philosophy programs, gender studies programs, music programs? And then I realized, well, in philosophy, you can do it all, right? Philosophy is the queen of the sciences, right? I didn't have to narrowly focus, right? Because I could just be kind of, as a philosopher, you know, dip my toe in whatever. So I went to grad school in philosophy. This is 2000. And with the intention of, I did an undergraduate thesis on Schoenberg's Kantian notion of genius.
Okay, so that seems very traditionally philosophical.
Yeah, yeah, but that was, that emerged from an independent study I did where I was like, the emancipation of the dissonance and like the sort of no gods, no masters things in existentialism seem to have something to do with one another. What is it? Right. So again, sort of, you know, bigger picture philosophical questions. But then I think just my own interests, right? So this is, you know, early 2000s is when Poptimism, right? So 2004, the Rap Against Rockism article gets published, right? So like kind of zeitgeisty stuff happening in the music world, right? Thinking about, you know, sort of the boundaries of musical values, they relate to gender and race, like those were just kind of in the atmosphere, and that also influenced my research. And that's kind of how I ended up kind of where I am today. Like, for example, I had a dissertation chapter where I went through all of Adorno's writings on popular music and said, it's really interesting, he tends to mention women's body parts anytime he talks about like commodity music or popular music. So again, that's a more traditional sort of musicological approach, but kind of looking for things that a feminist philosopher would look for.
I see. That's interesting. Okay.
Yeah. And then over grad school, I think my focus kind of shifted more towards popular music because that was where I could ask that. Well, that was where some of the questions that I was interested in asking were being asked, right? Like in the Khalifa Sana article and in some of the you know, Ann Powers, the extra academic side of popular music studies.
Right. At what point did you like say, okay, there's an Adele song or a Taylor Swift song, and I want to write whatever, a 45 page like book chapter about it. Like, at what point did that click as a way to these pop songs, as a way to understand the philosophy of whatever 2015 or something?
Yeah, I think it was once I got out of grad school and didn't have to do primarily what other people wanted me to do, right? I didn't have the committee there saying, no, you should do it this way. I could just do what made sense to me. So I think my first published article was about Peaches and Chicks on Speed and Judith Butler.
Okay.
Right? So like kind of as soon as I got out of grad school, and didn't have to, you know, do philosophy just for philosophers, I started, I guess maybe it was always kind of emerging or latent, but I hadn't really had I had to be too narrowly in a philosophy box to do. So I did that, and that was published in Hypatia, which is a feminist philosophy journal. But then my next journal article was in JPMS on Beyonce and Rihanna and Afrofuturism. I think the sort of interdisciplinary perspective is hard to have as a grad student because grad programs tend to be pretty disciplinary, and what they're trying to do is train you to be a participant in that discipline. But then once I wasn't confined to that, I got to, you know, sort of figure out my own identity as a scholar more, and sort of, you know, who are my real interlocutors and who's my real audience beyond my three dissertation committee members.
I'd love to, you know, talk a little bit about this currently in progress project you've been working on and putting out chunks of on your website and newsletter and in talks, which is about this kind of philosophical understanding of the very contemporary phenomenon of vibes. So like how do you define vibes in terms of what they've meant to the online discourse of the last like decade or so? And why is this like a subject of inquiry for you?
Yeah. Great question. So if you look at how people on the internet today use the term vibe, it means something like an orientation or a profile, right? Like this is, you know, we can say like, this person has a chill vibe. That means their relationship to or direction toward other things, right, is chill, right? Or you would, you know, ascribe to them a profile, right? So it's not like an identity, but it's, you know, when you think about profile in the sense of like psychological profiling, what you're doing is you're taking a bunch of data points, right, and putting them together to think about what trajectory someone is on.
Okay.
Right. Like when the FBI profiles a serial killer, what they're doing is they're trying to say like, okay, what has this person, what sort of tidbits of information has this person left to help us understand their state of mind or trajectory so that we can figure out what they're going to do next and catch them.
And that's right? Their vibe, the profile.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you look at how Spotify, for example, understands users, that's exactly how they understand users, right? You leave behind these breadcrumbs of data, Spotify creates a profile of you to figure out what you want to listen to next, what trajectory are you on, right? So the project argues that part of the reason why vibes language grew popular on the internet in the early 2020s is because it's a vernacularization of the practices of perception that the algorithms in the black boxes use to perceive us, right? We've sort of learned how to think that way by interacting with our various devices, training our TikTok algorithm, for example. Like I'm a rigorous TikTok algorithm trainer. You know, like I only want to see the kinds of things I want to see,
sure,
and I
sure,
don't
sure,
really
right.
veer off because I don't want to get random boring content, right?
What are the kinds of things you want to see, just out of curiosity?
Dogs and techno.
Okay. So that's your vibe is?
Yes, is okay. Dogs and techno.
Okay.
Yeah. 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 But I've trained the For You page to show me those things by
sure.
giving them information, right? So we've learned how to interact with algorithms so that they perceive us in ways that we want to be perceived. So it makes sense that we're starting to use that just to describe ourselves generally.
So, I mean, one of the sentences, vibes are how we perceive ourselves the way AI and finance perceive us. So like the idea is basically like we now, instead of talking about someone's personality or some other frame of reference, you would simply, we have adopted the language of how Spotify sees us or how TikTok sees us and say like their vibe is XYZ. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And if you look at how social media users construct a vibe, they do so in very similar ways, right? So there's one of the newsletter posts, I compared Instagram and TikTok posts, sort of like that would put together a couple of different pictures or a couple of different objects in a picture to the way that people explain collaborative filtering recommendations, right? And which is you put together a bunch of data points, right? You know, like there's this one that shows a guy in a brown haired guy in a blue cycling kit who just bought a pizza with mushrooms and a salad, right? And one of them bought a Coke next. And the next one's like, well, what's he going to buy next? Probably a Coke, right? So there's this collection of images that point in a trajectory. And that's exactly how social media users visually construct a vibe on TikTok and Instagram, right? So it was really fascinating to me that like the visual representation of a vibe, you know, and this technical explanation of how collaborative filtering algorithms work is basically the same as how, you know, influencers are visually representing a vibe on social media.
So like an example of that would be like if someone took a picture of like their whatever writing space and I don't know, hashtagged it like writing vibes or something like that. Is that?
Yeah. Or like if you say I went on a picnic and I like took a picture of some trees and then the picnic blanket and then maybe like my friend eating some food, right? And I called it picnic vibes, right? I have all these little data points that I'm collecting together to point to a profile, right? Sunny, nature, you know, sitting on the floor, sharing.
Right, right, right.
That
and so what, like what, so what interests you about this and what do you think it says that we have chosen in some way to make ourselves like AI or see the world like AI sees us?
I don't think it's a choice. I think it's just kind of the way things evolve. But what's interesting to me philosophically about this is the way that vibes get presented as less oppressive and more inclusive, or somehow more progressive than old categories like gender or genre, right? So there's a whole, one of my favorite TikTok influencers, Griffin Maxwell Brooks, non-binary Thembo, has a video of them saying, I'm not a boy or a girl, I'm a vibe, right? So there's, you know, like gender, binary, bad, vibes, amorphous, good, right? And Spotify also talks about genre in this way, right? So if you think about genre, right, the music industry made genre to be identity laden, right? If we go back to the earliest 20th century, right, like genre has, in, at least in the industry, genre has its roots in narrow identity categories, mm-hmm. right?
So selling certain kinds of music to African-American listeners, and that shapes how the kind of segregation of the industry over the 20th century.
Yeah. So genre has this identity laden baggage, right? You know, pop is for girls, hip hop is for African-Americans, that sort of thing. So what industry people now say is, oh, genre, you know, it's so tied up in these limiting, racist, sexist identity categories. Vibes are all inclusive, right? So if you look at vibe playlists, there's one chill vibes playlist. I don't know if it's still around on Spotify, but this is some research I was doing in around 2021. They had everyone from like Taylor Swift to Dwight Yoakam to Ryuichi Sakamoto. And I'm like, these things otherwise don't go together. Right? But if you take the sort of most toned down version of all of these artists' catalogs, there's a similar profile, even though all of the other sociological associations with these artists would show no relation, right?
Right.
So vibe gets presented as, you know, getting rid of, you know, limiting demographic categories like identity ones, and giving us a more progressive, inclusive form of categorization based on how people behave rather than who they are. But as I've kind of shown in, I guess this is sort of a trajectory in a lot of my research, these things that get presented to us as more progressive than the old 20th century or modernist versions aren't necessarily so, sure. Right? So what I'm arguing then is that, so vibe gets presented as more progressive than things like genre or gender, but what it's doing is it's just reconfiguring the way we categorize people and categorize music to be compatible with the way algorithms organize us, right? And there is, you know, we sort of have a growing body of scholarly literature that says, well, these algorithms are only as progressive as the data that we train them on is, and that's not so progressive. So yeah, vibes language is a way of sort of masking retrenchment as progress.
So the, I mean, you know, in the sense that we can never be quote unquote post-racial, like this is a post-racial, post-gender curatorial approach to music making, but in fact, all of those categories are still kind of in part and parcel of it.
Yeah, they're just being remade in different forms, right? So for example, Spotify has this flagship vibe playlist called Pollen.
Right.
Interesting, if you think about the name, right? Supposedly identity list, right? Pollen has its own sort of gendered connotations, interestingly, right? But if you look at Pollen and compare
it
to...
What would you say are the gendered connotations of pollen?
Well, pollen comes from male plants.
Okay. Oh, I didn't even think about that. Right. Okay. So there you go.
Yeah. Yeah. Pollen comes from male plants. So pollen is sort of the forward-thinking, cutting-edge, very kind of mumbly hip-hop influenced playlist, right? So it's sort of chill, but it's definitely in that space of like lo-fi hip-hop and that general universe, but it's hip-hop heavy. It has a sibling playlist called Lorem, which is Billie Eilish, very sort of dream poppy, right? Sort of toned down, very much more oriented towards femme audiences, right? Even if you look at the composition of the listeners, right? So it's interesting to see how the gendered breakdown persists, even though supposedly this is not about pop or rock or pop or hip hop or, you know, masculine and feminine. It's about different vibes, but the vibes end up hashing out in the same old ways.
Right. Well, it's interesting you said femme. Like, would these two playlists be like mask and femme, which is more identity, like more progressive identity than men listen to this and women listen to this? Or,
well, yeah. So, for example, data studies scholar John Chaney Lippold has a paper out. It's probably 2009, I think. It's called New Algorithmic Identities. And it talks about how algorithms can basically feed user data back into how they define gender category or any category, right? So no category is essentialist anymore. Any category is adaptive and sort of fluid and fuzzy, right? So yeah, this is more fluid, right, and less essentialist than before. But again, the techniques of governance and power have also adapted to work in that way, right? So yes, it represents some degree of progress past that old form, but so have patriarchy and white supremacy progressed past their former iterations, right? To work in, to take advantage of the, what for them are affordances of new technologies, new relations of productions, new ideological formations.
Right. How would you, in terms of, you know, racial exclusion or racial segregation that, you know, was part of the history of musical genre as conceived by the record industry, how do you see that playing into this new version of post-genre vibes in terms of how these playlists might be racialized or involve some acts of exclusion of certain kinds of music or musicians?
So 24K Golden's hit from a couple years ago, Mood, was explicitly designed to sort of cross the hot alternative hip hop and pop charts. And in doing publicity for the song, the duo sort of compares their own multiracial identity to the multi-genre-ism of the song, right? So that's presented in both cases as an advantage. But if you look at who counts or who gets perceived as multiracial, you know, there's a significant amount of anti-blackness in that as well, right? Like these are light-skinned, you know, kind of brown, racially ambiguous people. These are not sort of, you know, super dark-skinned, you know, African diasporic people. And even in one of my older articles is the post and post identity, the post and post genre. It sort of talks about how you're only seen as post if you're seen as overcoming old sort of black white binaries, right? And how Latin American artists, because race works different in Latin America, right? And the politics of race are different, right? Someone like Pitbull or even Bruno Mars is not seen as sort of overcoming sort of past black white binaries because they're working in contexts where you know, in Latin America, mestizaje is sort of seen as it's presented as progressive, right? So when you're working in a context that already, you know, values mestizaje, performing that isn't seen as progressing past, right? You have no old black-white binary to progress past, right? So artists that can be read as sort of overcoming old binaries, right? They're seen as mixing, for example, black and white, rather than excluding one or the other, right? Whereas, you know, sort of artists who would be seen as working primarily within a hip hop tradition, for example, right? You see the ongoing demonization of drill, right? Both in primarily in the UK, but also in the US context, right? You know, genres that are primarily associated with African Americans still continue to be demonized and criminalized, right? Because they're seen as sort of just for this one narrow black community, right?
I see. So if you can't achieve this kind of post-genre, post-identity thing, then you're being left behind in some way almost.
Right. And this maps onto how mixed race studies scholars talk about sort of shifting post-racial norms,
Okay.
right? Where, you know, whereas the, you know, sort of in the 19th and 20th century, hypo descent or the one drop rule, you know, is about maintaining the purity of whiteness against everything else. Now we've sort of shifted. This is Jared Sexton writes about this in Amalgamation Schemes. He says we've sort of shifted to a context where there's mixed, right? And that's good. And then blackness is seen as pure, and that's bad, right? So it's sort of a flip, right? So we used to be about protecting the purity of whiteness, but now in sort of neoliberal post-racialism, it's about sort of constructing things that are perceived to be purely for or about Black communities, Black people, as inflexible, non-adaptive, non-resilient, right? Like basically unable to exhibit the flexibility, right, that, you know, something like a multi-genre or a multiracial person supposedly represents or exhibits.
Yeah. Right. So kind of zooming out for a project like this, like what would you hope that someone who hashtags their, you know, the picture, the Instagram they took of their breakfast vibes, or enjoys listening to these playlists and thinks that they're much more, you know, compellingly curated for their identity than whatever the top 10 hip hop songs playlist. Like, what do you want them to think about as they embark on their online curation of their vibe activities?
Yeah. So I don't think vibe in itself is inherently bad. Like, you know, if you're just like talking about, you know, brunch vibes,
sure,
fine. But also think about how that makes you more legible, right? To, you know, both the platform that you're on and the everything tracking you, right? Like, so just be aware of that, right? Like, this practice makes you more, you're like pre-packaging yourself, right? As a data subject, right? Here, let me give you all this for you, right? So just be aware of that. But I would also just want people to be aware of the fact that vibes, we are being policed for our vibes, right? I mean, you see this quite literally. You know, the TSA has a program where they have plainclothes officers just sort of in the airport looking for, you know, how you're acting, right? It's literally a form of psychological profiling, but what, you know, like, is this person nervous? Do they look nervous, right? So like, that's just a particularly explicit example of how we're being policed for our vibes. But there's there are workplace technologies that, for example, there's one workplace technology that requires you to work the copier, you have to smile, right? So it's doing facial recognition to make sure, yeah. So it's making sure that you're like happy at work. And in order to just get basic tasks done, you have to do this sort of weird, not quite emotional labor, but you have to perform happiness or complacency or something like this. Plagiarism detection, right? So sort of video proctoring software definitely is another example of vibe policing, right? Are you paying attention, right?
Right.
You know, like that's the kind of vibe policing that we're seeing these days. And this is just sort of in its infancy. So I'd want to think, you know, like, what are the broader, like, how are the practices involved in seemingly innocuous vibe culture actually being put to use in things that are far from seemingly innocuous, like surveilling workers, policing students taking tests, that sort of thing.
Yeah. I don't know if this relates, but I'm curious if it relates, which is, you've been posting for the last couple of years about your Peloton experiences and how they relate, how music is being curated in your Peloton workouts. Can you talk a little bit about that, if whether or not it relates to vibes?
It sort of does. So I think the thing that's really interesting about Peloton as a platform is it's sort of right between the old and the new, right? It's this sort of like cusp case that helps, I think, the old and the new sort of come in greater clarity, right? So on the one hand, Peloton works on a very traditional broadcast model, right? There's no personalization,
right?
You get the classes either, you know, sort of live streamed or pre-recorded, but it's one direction, right? There's no sort of feedback. You know, my stream of classes doesn't change based on what classes I've taken in the past, right? Which is how YouTube and Spotify work, right? So it's sort of a more traditional broadcast model. But on the other hand, it does have aspects of, you know, what we would call streaming platforms, right? You can like songs, right? And that sort of then feeds directly into your Spotify. There's personalization at the level of fitness data.
Oh, interesting.
Right? So I have an Apple Watch and that connects it tracks all my fitness data, right? So there is personalization there, right? And that level of sort of personal monitoring and surveillance, right? So it's, you know, sort of doing both sort of the broadcast industry model and the platform data model. It treats music on the one hand as a format, right? So Eric Weisbard has this book, Top 40 Democracy, where he sort of goes in detail on the difference between a format and a genre. And he says format is, it's a radio industry term tied to demographics, right? Like who's your audience? And genre is an aesthetic system tied to like the properties of the music that's broadcast, right? So on the one hand, Peloton sticks pretty closely to formats, right? It talks about pop rides, or they have yacht rock rides. I would love to see a grime ride someday. They finally have techno rides, and they treat individual instructors almost like formats, right? Like Ben Aldis is the EDM guy, okay. And Hannah F is the, you know, the British dance music person. But on the other hand, they do have mood rides, right? And they also
talk, so like a hashtag chill ride or something. Like what is a mood
they have
ride?
Like happy or okay, angry, okay. You know. So instead of just calling it like a speed metal ride,
sure,
it's angry, right? And they do, you know, sort of treat. They're linked directly up with Spotify, right? So you can like things like individual songs in your workout, and that will appear in your Spotify if you link Peloton right, and Spotify, right? Right? So they're between, you know, sort of formats and vibes.
So let's maybe close out a little by talking briefly about your new project, the book coming out in May 2023, which is a history of the Cincinnati rock station WOXY. You know, I really enjoyed reading it. It's much more kind of historical than philosophical compared to some of your other work. Like what led you to want to work on that project? And that seems in many ways different from a lot of your other writings.
Yeah, it is really different. So I grew up outside of Cincinnati, listening to WOXY from about sixth or seventh grade on until when the station closed in 2010, right? So this is, in some ways, WOXY was my first musical education, right? Like I learned, yeah. And so most people have a sort of like, oh, I learned about pop music from my dad. My dad didn't like music and his favorite artist is literally Rick Astley. So
does he enjoy being Rickrolled or does he not like being Rickrolled?
Sadly, he passed long before Rickrolling. That's okay. No, that's fine. Yeah. So growing up, my dad wasn't into music and, you know, sort of the music he was into was Rick Astley and not something I was interested in knowing more about as a kid. So my musical education was really sort of what was on this station. And WXY was what we think is the sixth modern rock station in North America. So they initially modeled their programming on K-Rock, which was one of the first. Right. So I grew up listening to this station and, you know, really cared about it. They are perhaps, we can't prove this, but they're what we think is the first FM station to move their broadcasts entirely online.
Huh. Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And they did that for reasons I talk about in the book and we can get into later. But so I grew up with this station. It mattered a lot to me. It closed in 2010 when they ran out of money for the online station. And, you know, for the longest time, I was like, you know, I'm a pop music scholar. I know there's a story here. Maybe I'm not the one to tell, or I can't figure out how to tell it, but somebody should write a book about this. You know, this is an important sort of piece of pop music and radio history, right? Rolling Stone called it the last great independent radio station in the early 2000s, right? So, you know, so I always knew it was important, but I never quite figured out, like, am I the person to tell this story? And if so, what would that story be? Well, so in 2019, I realized that we were coming up on the 40th anniversary of the first Modern Rock 500, which was their annual countdown of the most important or best modern rock songs ever. And so I wrote a story for Belt Magazine about the Modern Rock 500. And as I was writing that story, I realized, well, okay, so the thing, like the narrative of WOXY or the story of WOXY is actually the station's idea of independence, right? The idea that independence is something that can only be achieved if you practice it with and for other people, right? So it's an independence to rather than an independence from. I was like, so that's what made the station, and that's a philosophy. And who better to tell the story of a philosophy than me? So once I kind of figured out the narrative hook for this story, it just kind of all came from there. And writing the book was actually, that was my pandemic project, and it was kind of the perfect pandemic project because I got to meet and to interact with many members of the WOXY community. The station's former owner, Doug Balog, mailed me bespoke archival finds from his extensive personal archive. Yeah. And I talked with a lot of people over email, over Zoom. It's just been, you know, really, and that sort of, again, reflects the philosophy, right? You know, people in this community want to help people do cool and original stuff. And that's what I argue in the book is the you know, this idea of independence too, where we all help each other do whatever weird thing that we want to do. That's the only way that any one of us, and thus all of us, can actually be independent.
Hmm. Yeah. I think that's a perfect note to end things on. Thank you so much.
Great. Yeah, thanks. This was fun.
Many thanks to Robin James for that great conversation. You can read more about her work over on our website, soundexpertise.org. Our inbox is open. If you have questions or thoughts about the show, email us at soundexpertise00@gmail.com or tag me on Twitter or Instagram at @seatedovation. I'm grateful to D. Edward Davis for his production work. You can check out his music on SoundCloud at Warm Silence. Many thanks to Andrew Delantonio for transcribing our episodes to make them more accessible. This episode of Sound Expertise was recorded at the National Foreign Language Center with support from University of Maryland's School of Music. And next week on Sound Expertise, what we can learn about listening and music making from Indigenous thought.
What we're doing now is we are approaching that community and saying, were you aware that your song exists in this context? If not, how would you guide us? Are you able to guide us in redressing this from a cultural perspective? And that will unfold. I mean, I think this will probably be a lifetime's work.
See you then.